Hello, and welcome to episode 223 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
On today's show, we wrap up our occasional series, which was inspired by Rick's lecture series called The Search for Meaning. So far, we've explored truth, goodness, love, beauty, the soul, and justice. Each has revealed a distinct aspect of what it means to live a meaningful life. For our final episode in the series, we turn to nature and what our relationship with the natural world reveals about balance, stillness, and the way we live. Rick, why does our disconnection from nature sometimes signal something deeper about meaning, not just environmentally, but personally?
The natural world moves to its own pace. There's all these creatures out there that are living, you know, in a habitat that's been developed over millions of years. They don't respond or adjust real quickly to the ways in which we've changed the world, and they certainly don't live on a clock like we do. Our lives are so structured, not just by the clock, but all kinds of concerns that we have, the jobs that we do. It's all dependent on technology and various forms of structures that we impose upon the world, ways in which we change nature. Finding meaning for most of us comes through the ways we intervene in the world, the activities we do, the things we get done, the things we check off our to-do list. But getting meaning from nature requires most of all that we be receptive, that we just watch and observe. And for many of us, that's really hard to do. Like we're living in a state of constant distraction. So then to get comfortable without the distractions can be challenging.
I had the opportunity, as I've had through much of your lecture series, to attend last night at Viterbo. And one thing you sort of started off by talking about was something I hadn't heard much about before, and about how there's a theory that you can read nature like a book. And that was interesting, and I hadn't really thought about it that way. And let's be honest, you probably spent more time out in nature over your life than I have over mine. But you told a real interesting story last night about a drive from western Wisconsin up to, was it central or western North Dakota?
Yeah.
And how someone who has even a deeper knowledge about nature taught you a thing or two.
Yeah. So I was on a duck hunting trip with a group of friends, and I was driving with Mark Schultz, who's a longtime friend. He's a retired conservation agent from the county here and knows a lot about the land. And he keeps up a running commentary on this whole drive about what he's seeing in the landscape. As we get towards western Minnesota and eastern Wisconsin, there's a lot of potholes, and he's talking about like what formed the potholes.
You said eastern North Dakota, you mean?
Eastern North Dakota, yeah. And then he's pointing out, you know, he can see where fields have been drained, where there used to be wetlands and where there used to be natural forest, and now that's been clear cut, or there's second or third generation forest. And this is just not the way I'm accustomed to looking at the land. And I just found it fascinating that somebody can just look out at a landscape and understand immediately, like everything has a meaning for him. And this is stuff that just looks, well, it looks empty.
Right? Yeah.
And
that's a long drive for those who don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was more or less constant during this long drive, just these observations. And that's what I meant by reading nature like a book. The idea of reading nature like a book has a long, long history, thousands of years. But like I saw it in action there from somebody who really knows the landscape well.
And that reminded me of a time, and it was a much shorter drive, and it was someone who's not as steeped in nature as your friend is. But I remember many years ago going on probably a 45-minute or hour-long drive across Iowa with my grandmother, and she has lived almost her entire life in Iowa. And I never really thought of her as someone who spent a lot of time outside or someone who was like embraced nature in all the ways a lot of people do. But as we were driving, and I forget the season, but we were driving down these county highways and state highways, and she would be like, oh, I see the soybeans are being planted, or I see, you know, and I was just so surprised that even someone who I didn't think had this close connection to nature in that short drive across a land she knew very well was able to talk about all these things she saw. And maybe some of it was nature, maybe some of it was agricultural, but it just kind of gave me the same thought of like, I would have done this drive by myself and just thought, yeah, there's nothing to see. I just can't wait. I just, you know, you see the 15 miles to your destination and just can't come soon enough. And it is interesting to see things through a different eye. You mentioned also last night when this reading history as a book, kind of a lost art in a way, you really believe, I think, that this is something, a skill we should impart to our children so they can be more like my grandmother or your conservationist friend.
Yeah, and this comes from Aldo Leopold, who says that we have to learn to understand what we love. This moves us towards a kind of environmental or conservation mindset, an idea of taking care of the land. But understanding what we love is the second step. The first step is loving nature in the first place. And so there's two steps here that are really important for children. First is just becoming acquainted with the outdoors and then becoming curious about what they see. And so that they begin that process of investigation. And this is fairly easy to do. Children are just naturally curious. And so you take them outside and you just ask them to discover things and they'll start discovering. And then they can pretty quickly learn the names. And once they learn the names of things, they start seeing it. They start recognizing it. And this is the process of what we might call nature literacy, right? Learning to read nature.
And just a few minutes ago, you sort of set this up by saying that when done properly, us humans can go out in the natural world and observe and see things that we might not normally have seen. And you mentioned how, you know, our lives are so different than, you know, these critters, and you know, we have to sort of slow down and appreciate things. But I guess what maybe the question I want to get to is, if we do this the right way, if we have more literacy around nature, if we're able to read what's around us better, is it, if we do it just right, can we almost become part of nature, that we're not some invading force, that we are sort of just another part of the natural world? Is that kind of the goal here?
That's certainly the goal. And for Aldo Leopold, who is really my hero, like the greatest conservationist, who published his book, Sand County Almanac, in 1949, but it really became popular in the 1970s. He thought we need to see land as a community to which we belong, as members of a community, not something that we just exert control over for our purposes. And so the goal is to help us understand in what way are we members of this really vast and fascinating community, and so that we're interdependent with all the other creatures. We don't only become just members of the community, I think. We've become so intrusive into nature right now. We've altered the landscape in ways that are not reversible entirely. And it's not clear we want to. Like, we've made so many advances in agriculture. We're able to feed billions of people. That was not possible using the kinds of agricultural techniques that were common a century ago. And so we're always going to have some kinds of practices that are really not, I would say, healthy for the land and don't reflect just being members of a community. But we need to learn to balance, like, how we exist in relationship to nature, so that everything we do is not an exploitation.
As you did during these past presentations at your college, you did this presentation or this lecture for about a half hour, and then you encouraged the people like us in the audience to break into small groups and discuss some of the issues that you brought up. And it was interesting. In the group I was part of, there was a young man there. He was in college, not at your college, but another college here in our city. I don't know, probably 19, 20, 21 years old. I didn't ask for sure. And he told an interesting story. He grew up in the Milwaukee suburbs, seemed like he had a good childhood, had nothing bad to say about it, but also said like he, just because of being in the suburban ring around a big city, you know, his nature experience was like going to the city park. And not that that's nothing, but that's like a different experience. And he came here, not surprisingly, not really knowing all the natural wonder of this region. And I even asked him, I said, is that something, as they're trying to sell you on why to come to the city and come to college, did they talk about that? And he said, no, they really didn't. That was just something he sort of discovered on his own while he was here. But he said, and I assume this was during the spring and fall, certainly not in the middle of winter like we're at now in Wisconsin, he actually had taken a hammock a number of times up to this bluff country that from his university is a mile, maybe a mile and 2 miles away, and would spend the night up in the wilderness. And he said it was a little uncomfortable the first time, or even maybe every time, but the stillness really made him appreciate the natural world around him. And that stillness is something you touched on last night, where you can experience, especially when you're coming from the suburbs or the city like him, and this stillness can be sort of a little different than we're used to, maybe a little scary at times, but also a good thing, right?
Well, you know, if you're alone and you're far enough away from roads and sidewalks and buildings and everything, you don't have to be in a completely wild area, but you're still in an area where wild creatures are frequenting, and it's not our natural environment, right? And when you're still and quiet in an area like that, it can be really unsettling. And it's unsettling for a couple of reasons. First of all, because most of us right now are just not accustomed to living without screens and artificial noises and things like that. So to be surrounded by natural sound, natural sights, that can be unsettling because we can't control anything. Can't change the channel. Can't turn the volume up or down or anything like that. You have to change your mode of engagement to just being receptive. And this means being vulnerable. When you're receptive, you're also vulnerable, right? And when you're active, you're kind of more aggressive. You're in a different kind of mental posture. And that takes a little while to get used to. And so good for him, like good, and good for him to just, for just immersing himself in this.
And he even talked about too, and I'm guessing he sometimes goes on these hikes with friends. I don't know, probably. But he also talked about how he really likes going up there by himself. And I think these sort of overnight stays up there were almost, if probably all the time, by himself. And that is a different experience when you're, and again, I don't, it's not like he's hiking out to the most remote part of America, but this is still, like, for those who don't know, I mean, you're up sort of in this little bluff country and you're surrounded by trees and forests, and it's, these trails are a pretty complex trail system. I mean, you are sort of, for our part of the country, a little bit in the wilderness, and it does take a little bit of, I don't know if I call it bravery, but a little bit of, it's something that you really have to want to do.
Yeah, you have to seek it out, and you have to be determined, because it's easy to turn back.
Yeah.
Trail like that, to pack your stuff up and say, I've had enough of this, I'm heading home. And especially when home isn't that far away. That kind of a journey, even if it's, say, just a mile or so outside of town, we happen to live, for those who aren't familiar with La Crosse, we're in an interesting kind of area here, a geographical area between pretty high bluffs and the Mississippi River. The size of the city is constrained by that.
It'll very long and narrow along this corridor.
Yeah, so if you go either east or west, you quickly get out of the city and into some pretty wild areas, because the river is the Upper Mississippi National Wildlife Refuge. And then on the other side are the bluffs. Many of that, a lot of that land is preserved and has hiking trails through it. So it's pretty easy to get outside of the constructed or the built environment And this is a journey not just into wilderness, because it's not really wilderness, but there's some wild things. I've encountered a wolf on the trail, not more than maybe half a mile from a major highway here, you know, on a hiking trail. I think it was a juvenile wolf in the spring that was ranging outside of its territory. But you really don't know what you're going to encounter, yeah. Right? You get just a little ways out. But the important thing is it's also a journey of kind of self-discovery. So here's this young person who's coming here as a student, taking all sorts of classes, figuring out, I presume, like what he wants to do with his life. But he's also taken these other kinds of journeys out, like into some unfamiliar areas where he's learning something about himself, how he responds to an environment that he doesn't control, right? And yet he certainly still has to have some agency within it. So these are very valuable kinds of experiences that I wish more young people would take advantage of.
Last night and in your column, you do talk a lot about Aldo Leopold. And you mentioned the La Crosse area, which is tucked in western Wisconsin along the Mississippi. Leopold spent a lot of his time in this area and maybe in central Wisconsin. For those who are maybe familiar with the Wisconsin Dells area, he spent a lot of time in an area near there. Before last night, I know you had thought highly of and talked a lot about Leopold, and you sort of unpacked that in more detail in your talk. Maybe you can tell listeners why his writings, why his teachings, why his sort of life's work still resonates with you these many years later.
Yeah, so Leopold is a fascinating character because he forms a transition between an older generation of nature writing, people like Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson, John Muir, and which was in a way kind of more philosophical, contemplative, and modern environmental writing, which can be contemplative, but it tends to be more practical, focused on environmental issues and solutions of what we do. And he forms kind of a bridge between this older tradition and the newer. And he wrote this series of essays that got published in 1949 as a Sand County Almanac that did not do well at the time, but then got picked up really in the 1970s. Like young people discovered it.
Long after he's gone.
Long after he's done. In fact, like he died in just a few months before it was published in 1949. So he didn't see the set of essays published, and he certainly didn't. I don't think anyone foresaw the kind of immense influence it would have. To date, it's sold over 2 million copies worldwide. It's been translated into 14 or 15 languages. It has been hugely influential. And I think there's a reason for that influence. The first part of the book, it's in three parts, but the first part is the almanac part, where he does an essay for each month. So you can follow his observations, the stories he tells about observations on the land month by month. So he's seeing the migrations of birds in the spring and the fall. He's seeing in the winter time the creatures that occupy the landscape in the winter, rabbits and grouse and things like this. And it's a fascinating book that you can pick up and just read little essays. And because the essays are so descriptive, you feel like you're right there in the landscape with him. And but there's a real purpose to this. He's writing this in the first part of the book, these descriptive essays that help you to fall in love with the land, like just help you to understand why he finds it so fascinating. And then you start finding your own backyard more fascinating because you're seeing some of the same things in your very backyard that he's seeing when he's out at the shack property where he did much of his writing. And then later on in the book, then he talks about the land ethic and the what he calls the conservation aesthetic, like why it's important to see beauty in the landscape, because then that translates into action to preserve, and what we need to do to preserve the land, and why it's important that we have some areas that are preserved as wild areas, why other areas that are more managed, where we're more intrusive, we ought to like figure out how we can make it most sustainable. So like we can cohabit this landscape with wild creatures.
In this series, The Search for Meaning, there's been a lot of topics you've touched on, and like justice and truth. And in those and the other topics, you really relied in many cases on the words and teachings of philosophers centuries and centuries ago, because these are things, you know, that justice has been an issue for as long as humans have been around. But am I right that this issue, nature, is a little different than those, in as much that if you go back 500 years, and I guess it depends where you are in the world, right? But in so much of our world, where people at one time almost always lived so much closer to nature, that this was, pardon the pun, but maybe second nature to them, right? That this was sort of like, well, of course, I mean, I rely on the land for my food. I know this area well because the seasons affect my life so immensely. Hundreds and hundreds of years ago sort of understood this intuitively. But as many people across the world became more urban, moved to cities, became more specialized in their work, they grew more disconnected from the land. And is that why people like Aldo Leopold and countless others are a louder voice in the past 100 or so years? Because as a society, we've really moved away from our connection with nature.
Yes and no, because that's I think what you just said is the story we usually tell ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like it's been a straight road from a close relationship with nature to not much at all.
Yeah, like I think whenever I think of these things, I think of like when I was a kid watching A Little House on the Prairie and thinking of the Ingalls family living, what was that, 18 somethings?
Yep.
And
yep.
they were like real close to nature.
Right. And at, you know, I as early, like even in the early 20th century, something like 50% of the population were farmers.
Yeah.
Right. And so as a population, yeah, like a greater percentage live close to nature in rural areas. But our cultural products have largely come from cities and have come from cities for a very long time, for about 2,000 years. And we even have writings from Plato in which Socrates talks about going outside the walls, but which he rarely did. Like and like those are the wild kind of unprotected regions, the areas of danger. The lawless areas are the areas outside between the cities. Everything good happens within the city walls. And so even 2,000 years ago, you have this idea that there's a real sharp contrast between the civilized and the uncivilized. The difference there is that the nature in some ways is always kind of taken for granted. Of course, like the natural world is expansive, and it's always there, and there's nothing we can do to change it. And so there develops an attitude in most civilizations is we're in a constant struggle against nature to kind of carve out these little areas of culture or civilization within this vast landscape that is always going to be there and might be beautiful at times, but is also threatening. That really begins to change with industrialization, where we start making large-scale changes to the landscape. And it's not really, I think, until the 19... Like there's some that see the effects earlier, but really in the popular consciousness, it's not really until the second part of the 20th century, say the 1950s and 60s, that we start to see in public consciousness the idea that we might be unalterably changing the natural world around us, and that we might lose something really valuable that we've always taken for granted. So Rachel Carson's A Silent Spring comes out, I think, in 1962, where she talks about not hearing birds anymore and how we may never hear them again because of the widespread use of DDT. And this really shocked people. And it shocked them because many people had been noticing that they're not hearing bird songs anymore. They're not seeing the birds as much, but not knowing why and not knowing that there's a specific cause to it. And so with Rachel Carson presented this kind of a warning shot to the consciousness of Americans about the dangers of pesticide use. And then you get a rediscovery of Aldo Leopold, who's writing about, like, we need to really appreciate the land because it's a source of great meaning in our lives. That all comes together to really change our understanding of what the natural world is about.
Also, last night in the small group discussions we had after your lecture, there was another person at our table, and I guess he's maybe 10 years older than I am, and he talked about growing up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and that's an extremely big and rural area, and he said growing up there, and also because the influence of his father, really made him appreciate and kind of fall in love with nature, and that's something that he still is an important part of his life today. And I shared, and I'll share with you now, that that is in stark contrast to my childhood. And I tell this story, but it's 100% true. We grew up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which is, you know, west central Wisconsin. And my parents were very much indoor people. And if we ever wanted to do a nature type thing, what we would do is there was this park that is kind of, I think it's still there, but was kind of in the center of town that had like a gravel road that sort of bisected the city. You could go along and you felt like you were in the woods, but you were really truly in the middle of the city. So occasionally, if we wanted to like get in touch with nature, our family would pile into the Buick and we'd drive through that park. And that was like as much nature as we got, which is, I'm sure, very different than this gentleman at our table who grew up in Upper Michigan.
Well, I tell you what, yeah. if you take a visit to any of the country's national parks, mm-hmm. which have become really crowded lately, like they've exploded in popularity. But most of the people are not getting out of their cars.
They're just driving through.
Or stopping, and they might stop at a trailhead and walk for 100 yards or so down the trailhead and then back. If you go to any of our national parks and you stop at a trailhead and you walk, say, a half mile in, you're not seeing anybody. The car is the main way that most Americans experience nature.
So I guess my family was sort of on the cutting edge.
Yes.
And as I'm sure people are listening, I'm sure people who are like you are avid outdoors people who will hunt and camp and fish and all those things. And there's also people who probably don't do that and maybe aren't interested in doing that. But there are still ways where they can build a relationship to the natural world. And for the people who are listening saying, oh, you know, that's all fine, but I'm not going to spend a week in the wilderness in a tent, or I'm not even going to be like the college student I talked about last night and take a hammock and put it between two trees up in a bluffland near where I live. What other ways can people sort of be in touch with nature and get all the benefits that we started talking about at the beginning of this episode?
Well, so I do these other things you talk about, you know, I hunt and fish and camp, and I love to take solitary backpacking trips, which I'll do occasionally into wilderness areas. But those are relatively extreme. I also, on a regular basis, just try to understand, like, what is the natural habitat within the city? Like, what are creatures doing? And you can't see that when you're just driving along the city. But if you take a walk in, especially in the quieter areas, in neighborhoods, or in parks, or even on the edges of parks, at unusual times, like before sunrise, it is amazing what you see. And I mentioned last night in the lecture, like I heard a barred owl in the neighbor's yard the other morning. I got up, it was around 5 in the morning, and I got out to take a walk in the dark, and here's a barred owl.
And you're in the middle of the city.
I'm right in the middle of the city, yeah. And there's all kinds of cameras and things that are showing, you know, foxes and coyotes in major cities. I mean, like in Chicago, you know, there's coyotes in the, I mean, we are not as separated from a lot of the natural world as we think. It's just that we don't take time to see it in the right time. So you don't have to go off hunting or fishing or camping or something like that. Just find a way to be unobtrusive and to observe. And it's remarkable what you can see in your surroundings. The other thing I really recommend people do is get the Merlin app on their phone.
Oh, I don't know what that is.
It recognizes bird songs.
Ah.
And so when you go outside and there's birds singing and you wonder, like, what in the world, what bird is that? You just turn on the app and it recognizes and IDs the bird for you, so you can connect the song with the actual bird. Because if you aren't walking along with somebody who knows the bird songs, like, how do you figure out what birds they are? So this is a very easy to kind of way to get acquainted with the natural environment in your own surroundings.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, here is my question for you. Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy recently released a video urging travelers to be more kind and considerate during the busy holiday flying season. As part of that message, he suggested passengers should stop wearing pajamas on flights and dress with a little more respect. Rick, here's my question for you. Let's say you're about to take a 5-hour flight that leaves late in the evening. After hearing Duffy's plea, would that change what you wear on the plane, and what considerations should guide that decision?
I saw Duffy's video. I thought it was kind of funny. I think it missed the mark. I think it became really controversial because people regarded that, like, many people thought, like, what does how you dress have to do with how you behave?
Yeah, kind of a schoolmarmy approach, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think.
But when I see something like that, the first thing I like to say is, well, what is there credible in it? How can you interpret this charitably? And I think there is a difference in an attitude that you both communicate to yourself and to others by how you dress. And when you dress up for something, when you go out, what you're doing is you're putting on a certain appearance. The word that comes to mind is something like respectability.
Mm-hmm.
Right, which communicates a kind of self-respect and a respect towards others. And I think he's trying to communicate something like that. The airport and the airplanes, this is not our home. This is a public place. And so you dress for, you put out a kind of a public persona. And here's what I think is important. Our public persona ought to be one of civility and respect. And there have been a lot of incidents where we find that people are not treating each other with respect. I'm not sure that Sean Duffy's message adequately communicates that, because I think the main thing is, like, that we need to be respectful of one another in public places like airports. You don't have to dress up in order to be respectful. And I don't think the message came across, but I think there's something to it.
So a couple of things. First of all, I should tell listeners that the more I thought about this topic, I almost pulled back this dilemma entirely, because I almost wondered if this could be an entire show, because I think it's interesting because a couple of things. You mentioned that when you're traveling, when you're in a plane, you're in a public space. I would actually go a little further than that. I think, like, restaurants and parks are public places. The reason I think an airplane, an airport is different is that you're sort of a part of a community, for whether it's for 2 hours or 4 hours. If you're at a restaurant and somebody's, like, being sort of not a great restaurant person, you know, not a good diner that's four tables over. It might slightly disrupt your enjoyment of the meal. But if you're on an airplane, I mean, everybody does sort of have to like work together. We've all been on planes where we're waiting and trying to have a tight connection, and the person two rows ahead of us is taking like 5 minutes to get their bags together and get out of the airplane. And that just like is not being part, you know, not being respectful of others in your community. But the other thing that you touch on, I think more broadly, is first of all, Duffy's position about we should all be more kind and considerate during the holiday season. Yeah, right. I mean, that's fine. I don't think many people would disagree with that. Where he got the pushback was like how you dress. And what it really got me thinking about was, and we all know this, whether it's at universities, whether it's at churches, whether it's at restaurants, where anywhere you go in public, people are not dressing as formally as they used to. And is that a bad thing? Is that, I mean, some would argue that we should all be comfortable, and especially if you're on an airplane, for example, comfort maybe is more important than looking professional. I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting thing because I think when you do dress up, I think there's something to the fact that you do sort of act a little more proper, I guess, and that maybe you're a little more conscious of how you act in those spaces. At the same time, this past summer, when I was on a 12 or 13 hour flight to Europe, and I got on the plane at 9 p.m. in the United States, I was not well dressed. I mean, I was wearing very casual. I was having, you know, comfortable shorts, kind of a loose-fitting long-sleeve shirt. And I was, the top of mind for me in that long flight was like, how can I be comfortable?
Because you're planning to sleep if you can, right?
What I think, maybe I got 10 minutes of sleep, but yeah, I was hoping to.
You're hoping to.
Yeah.
And so I think you're exactly right. Like there are times when you're flying where you want to be as comfortable as possible. These are the overnight flights or the evening flights and so forth. But there are times where, like, and I will change how I dress on a flight depending on kind of where I'm going and what I'm going to be doing when I get there.
Yeah, and that's part of it. If you're walking off the plane into an Uber and then into a presentation you're giving somewhere, you're not going to be wearing pajamas.
Right, yeah. And even if you're on an evening flight, I don't think you should be wearing pajamas, but you could wear, you know, you can wear sweatpants or something. You mm-hmm. can wear something really comfortable. So I think that's fine. And I also agree with you. There's ways in which, like, how we dress indicates something to ourselves about how we feel and how we're expecting to act. I will sometimes, even on a break where I'm just home and I'm just working, there'll be times where I'm not feeling very productive and I'm feeling especially lazy. And I will think, okay, I've got to put on some work clothes and so forth and get myself in the mood for being productive and being a little more responsible instead of just like dozing. And these are just ways in which how we dress creates for ourselves a certain kind of mental attitude. It's just a prompt for us. So I think it can have that effect, but there's still no excuse. Like if you're not being kind and considerate to people, it isn't because you didn't dress appropriately.
And I guess just taking that one step further, and this is where I kind of envisioned this, is if we were going to do a whole show on it, and obviously at this point we're not, but you've been standing in front of students for what, 30 plus years?
Yeah.
I'm guessing the dressing of those, how those students dress has changed a lot over those 30 some years, and maybe even what you're wearing has changed a lot over those 30 some years. And again, like I talked about, if you go out in public, whether it's to the grocery store, whether it's to church, whether it's to dinner, people are much more casual. And is that, I mean, does that ever bother you? Is that something you're like, geez, you know, what's, you know, the people just don't have respect for themselves or others when they show up to these places in sort of in very casual attire? Is that something that of all the problems we're facing in this world, is that even on the list of things you care about?
Yeah, it's somewhere on the list.
Okay.
And I I have never liked the idea, especially from some of my fellow faculty colleagues, the extremely casual look. And I'll dress fairly casually most of the time. It depends on what kind of meetings and who I'm going to be talking to. But I don't wear like the same clothes that I'm wearing at home to lounge around into the classroom. And I don't think it's appropriate. And I've had several colleagues over the years who feel differently about that. The worst was, I think, in the early 2000s.
Oh, okay.
There was a kind of reaction, and I think this happened mainly in academics, against the norm of business attire that was really common in corporate America, and a reaction to that among many academics of dressing in extremely casual wear, so jeans and t-shirts and things like that in front of the classroom, and to deliver public lectures. I always thought that was a big mistake. What they were trying to do is symbolize that, some, like, they're not in an ivory tower. They're really connected with what people think and regular concerns and things. But what came across is that they're just sloppy and they don't care. That, by the way, is a controversial statement, right? There is a matter of both respect and self-respect that you communicate by what you wear. And I think appearances are important.
One last thing before we go, and it's sort of a kind of an almost an ongoing joke between Travis and me, that when we're out to dinner at like a medium to nice restaurant, what absolutely drives him nuts, and he'll like, we'll be sitting there and he'll like start counting how many people within our sight lines, almost men, almost not always, but almost always men, are wearing baseball caps at the table. I'm not someone, I mean, only time I'll wear a baseball cap is like if I'm trying to like keep the sun out of my eyes or maybe going to a ball game. I'm not a big hat wearer, and neither is he. As I'm sitting here, I look over and I see a baseball cap sitting on the table next to you. I guess, does that bother you? I mean, when you're out to eat, that like all, and these people are sitting around at like a nice-ish restaurant and they're all, or many of them are wearing baseball caps?
You know, it doesn't bother me. I don't really notice it anymore because it is so common.
Yeah.
I wear caps all the time, and I always take it off inside.
And I will tell listeners, of course, who can't see, that I'm guessing you had that on when you came in the building, but now it's sitting on the table next to you.
Yep. And like in the winter when I'm wearing a coat or something like that, I'll take it off and set it on the table, or I'll stick it in the sleeve of my coat, right, so I don't forget it. But I'm not wearing it when I'm sitting down at the table.
And because?
It's become habit. I don't think about it. But then if you ask, like, is there a reason for it? Is there a reason that I even started that habit? I think it's a matter of respect. Yeah.
And you feel like, but a lot of people clearly don't feel that way.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of people that don't even think about it. Yeah. And so here's a response we get all the time when you bring up something like this. You say, it's just a cap, right? And this idea, it's just whatever you're talking about, like it doesn't matter. All kinds of things matter. Like everything we do matters in some way. It's a matter of like how much, how important is it? But hardly anything doesn't matter at all. And this is, like, if there's anything, like I'd like to get across in the course of our podcast, is, like, our whole lives matter. Everything we do matters. And everything we do sends something about an intention, a signal, like how we regard ourselves and how we regard others, how we regard the world around us. And wearing a cap is part of that.
As a reminder, The Ethical Life is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to look for Rick's column, which talks about many of the topics we covered today, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.